Good morning. And it's certainly been hot, hot, hot the last couple of days, that's for sure. And, the weather here in the Cincinnati area, if you stick around long enough, you'll see it change often enough, that's for sure. And we're going to cool down a little bit in the next couple of days, and then it looks like we'll ramp back up. So a little bit of insight there with the weather as far as what's ahead of us. And that's had a lot to do with where we've been thus far as well. And that's for sure. And I'm glad we're not in Nebraska. They're getting a lot of snow, some blizzard kind of conditions. And I'd rather it be a little cool and rainy here than see that stuff. And unfortunately, Ernie is out this morning again. This is his second week. We're still looking for him. So he's been missing. And we're thinking about contacting the milk companies to put a picture of his face on a milk carton in case we find him. And in Ernie's absence, we have David Kester with us this morning from the Boone County Extension, and he was in with us a couple of weeks ago. And always when Dave's in with us from the Extension office, it seems like we run out of time. There's not enough time. I've learned so many things from David over the years. So we thought, hey, come on in and co-host in Ernie's absence. And David, thank you for joining us again this morning, and welcome. And
I'm glad to be here. I'm a little worried about Ernie as well, but we'll find him.
We don't know where he is.
Yeah,
he's a busy guy, and then all of a sudden he's just been missing in action the last couple of weeks. But he always surfaces. He's like a bad penny. He just shows up.
I understand.
So how have you been? What's going on? What do you think about this weather pattern that we've been in? I mean, certainly this is not the typical April that we're accustomed
to seeing. It's really been a real roller coaster, and too much both ways. I think it's, you know, you'd really like to see more moderate temperatures and not the real fluctuations into really high and then really low again. And that's, you know, it gets plants started, and then they get a little bit of correction. And so hopefully we're going to be back into it next week.
So what's been the focal point at the Extension office the last couple of days? I mean, all of a sudden we ramp up into the 70s, and I know that I'm scrambling at the garden center. We're still trying to get things sorted out. You know, all the nursery stock that's been arriving, it's like I feel like I'm behind, right. And the parking lot's full, which I love. So it's like a catch-22 situation, right. And I know what it's like for us in the garden centers. What is it like for you guys at the Extension office when the weather just starts
We're starting to see plant samples coming in for disease and insect diagnosis, those kinds of things. And then, of course, turf is really, this is a time of year people like to control weeds and actually do some seeding. A little bit, you're still probably okay, but it's borderline now, and those kind of things are going on. And of course, this is a great time of year to be looking at if you've got fruit trees, those kinds of things. I still like to see people take a good look at their shade trees now before we get a lot of foliage on them, and just see if there's some corrective pruning that needs to be done, some branches that are crossing, or maybe some branches that broke in the winter, those kinds of things. Fruiting or flowering trees, of course, you don't want to be taking too much off before they become in full bloom. But we've, unfortunately, on a lot of magnolias and things like that, we kind of lost the blooms this year.
Oh, quickly. And, I like that idea that you just brought up, corrective pruning. I think this time of year, with the exception of, you know, some of the maples and things, you don't want to really cut into unless you absolutely have to.
Right.
But, I think you get a better representation of the structure of the tree without all the leaves being, you know, full blown and out, where when you cut a branch off, it's like, oh, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't have cut that one.
Yeah, you can't go back.
You can't put them back on, that's for sure. So, late winter, early spring is a good time to do a lot of that. And, you know, I often don't talk about it either, but I'm glad that you brought that up. So, and I encourage people all the time, open up that tree.
Right. And it's really, you know, we like those wide angle branches, and that's what we're looking for in our trees. And and especially if you have some of the pears and those things around, which, you know, we're kind of trying to get away from people planting those.
Man, we can talk about that one all day.
That's a tough one. And, opening them up.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny you say that. My dad, he has a camp out there off of DeCourcy, and just the other day, I think one of those Bradford pears just split right open on him. And that was the inevitable. You know it's going to happen. Right, it's just like when. And boy, were we fooled with a tree that we thought was so wonderful. I mean, so many problems have arisen from the pears.
Many, many years ago, I was at a conference, and Michael Durr said, these pears are just disasters waiting to happen.
Did he really? So he had the foresight of it? Mm-hmm. Wow. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And, I was talking with Vicky Tewish yesterday. She goes, please bring up the pears. Please. She said, my neighbor just put in some pears. And I'm like, I know in Ohio, I don't think you can sell them anymore.
No, they are outlawed or, illegal in some places.
Right. You know, and as you cruise along the expressways and so forth throughout the tri-state area, you see a lot of the volunteers.
Oh.
And they're everywhere. It doesn't seem as prominent thus far because they started the bloom, then we had that cold snap. So they're just not like sticking out in your face. They are to a degree,
right?
But not like the last couple of
years.
I'm
hoping that freeze kind of killed those blooms so we don't get fruit on them this
year. Exactly. That's what I was going to say. You know, do you find it, sometimes when I look at this, this whole issue with the volunteers, with the pears, I think in a lot of ways there's some benefit there because, they're holding back some of the hillsides, as far as erosion control is concerned. Just like the native
or honeysuckle.
The cedars too, the honeysuckles. But at the same token, they're also taking over land and space with our natives.
Right. Yeah. We usually the pioneer species in those would be locust. Black locust coming in and some of those kind of trees. And instead we've now got pears and, the honeysuckle and some of those things. So eventually our forest will go back to, but it's just going to be so long. And some of that stuff just, eradication of that is just almost impossible.
It is. Have you, are you still seeing a lot of issues with the emerald ash borer and ash trees?
Absolutely. Excuse me. The emerald ash borer is, there's an age where, we've now seen, and I was talking to Joe Boggs about it, that the emerald ash borer, it has killed the mature trees, but they will resprout from the root system there. Mm-hmm. And now the secondary, that resprouting is now becoming infected. So there's an age that, you'll see a young ash tree starting to look great and keep going. And then when it gets a certain age, then of course the emerald ash borer comes in and finishes it or begins to infect it and do the damage to it.
It's interesting too. When you think about, the emerald ash borer in a grand scheme of things and as it sweeps through an area, you would think it would move on to other ash trees and maybe dissipate.
Right.
But is that not the case?
Well, it is somewhat. I mean, it is moving, but they've done a pretty good job of keeping it intact and with the quarantines and things like that. But it's, if there's trees that haven't had it that are local, it's pretty tough not to become, unless you, of course, are treating it. And that's an ongoing
process,
and you've really got to. It's got to be a pretty special tree, and by all means, I think it's a great idea. And there's a number of our tree services that will do that for you.
Right.
And of course, you can do it yourself, but they're a little bit more effective with some of their procedures. But by all means, if it's a valuable tree in your landscape, I'd treat it.
Absolutely. And I say that a lot of times to homeowners. And the first thing that most homeowners are taking into consideration from what I can tell and see and what I hear, I should say, is like, wow, it's expensive to do that, to treat the tree. And my first response is typically, David, is how large is the tree?
Right.
What would it cost you to remove that tree?
Yeah.
What would it cost you to try and get a tree that size back in its place?
Right.
So there's a lot of issues there that I think it's cheaper to treat it.
Yeah, I think it's amazing what when you put the insurance value on a tree, it's significant. And I used to do that and evaluate trees and then, for insurance purposes. And, $5,000, $6,000 per tree was not, and that certainly isn't unusual.
Wow.
And that's the benefit it has to your home, the shading, and all the other benefits.
Are there formulations or tables with that kind of information on it based on a tree's circumference or trunk size?
And where it's located and the condition of the tree. It's the International Society of Arboriculture publishes that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, it's in a book, and you can figure out the value of it.
Interesting. Well, we got to take a quick break here. You're with Tony and Ernie in and around the house, your local home and garden guys. And we got to take a pause here, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And Ernie is out today. And in Ernie's absence, we've welcomed David Kester from the Boone County Extension Office to come in and co-host the show with us this morning. And kind of touch base on some various things that actually we didn't get to cover a few weeks ago when David was visiting us. And if you want to catch some of our past shows, too, feel free to go out onto our website and catch the podcast. John always keeps that up to date. And also feel free to send us an email to in and around the house at b105.com. I do my best to answer all the emails, and also keep in touch with us via our Facebook. We do our best to keep that up to date when we're not too busy, but nonetheless, stay in there and hang in there with us, because we always will eventually get back to you. And before we went into the break, we were just talking about some various things that we're starting to see, and customers are bringing in samples to the garden center of some various issues and so forth. And just as you were stating that a moment ago, David, you're starting to see that stuff at the extension office. It was yesterday that somebody had brought in some canes from her knockout rose bushes that looked like they were pretty well blistered up with canker.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that to be somewhat interesting, because typically your knockouts are pretty resilient from a disease standpoint. You know, insects is another issue.
Right.
But it's like, gosh, you know, cut that out, discard that, you mm-hmm. know, definitely throw it away, burn it. And also, I'm an avid believer in keeping your pruners sanitized as well. So throw some of your thoughts onto that, if you...
Well, a lot of people kind of are afraid to cut back their knockout roses. And I really think it's a lot of times they can benefit a great deal from being taken back, maybe as low as 10, 12 inches.
Right.
And then what I try to do when I'm pruning them is I want to prune them back to where a bud is going away from the center of the bush.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So that they'll break out, and then you'll have a little bit of more air movement in the center of the plant, and I think you get a little bit better bloom that way. But definitely knockouts need to be pruned. And we found out they're not as foolproof as we once thought they were. They will get mildew, and they do get this seem to be very prone to rose rosette virus, which we see an awful lot of. And there's, of course, no cure for that one. You just pretty much have to eradicate the plant and start over. And they just continue to breed roses. And I think we'll eventually see some that are really, really tough, and we don't have to worry about some of these things with them.
Yeah, you know, the other day I was talking with Tim Wood from Star Roses, and, you know, he and I have discussed rose rosette disease a number of times,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, ways to maybe prevent it or keep it at bay or, you know, checked, so to speak. And he told me there were some studies being done with horticultural oils.
Mm.
And I was trying to, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, where does that come into play? But, however it is, I'm not really sure, but like you just stated, I think once you see that in your rose bush, it's in it.
Right.
And my two cents, if it's worth anything, is to go ahead and lift that rose bush and try and get all the root structure.
Yeah, you really do. It's in the, you know, that virus is, as viruses are, they're throughout that plant. And you know, I've seen some Hibbertige rose growers who will prune that maybe a infected limb out. And it helps for a little bit, but you're going to see it again. And there really is one of the things that maybe for the for spraying was that you're trying to control the insects that, you know, they will feed on that infected rosebush, and then they'll go and feed on an uninfected one, and in their mouth parts, they will have that
exactly,
virus.
Exactly, they vector it that way as
and
well.
They'll vector it that way, and they'll move it. So controlling the insect, it's the same thing with the cucumber beetle on our cucumber
exactly.
mats.
No,
you don't.
Well,
you can't control the bacteria, but you can control the insect. So that's what we want to be doing.
Oh, it's really interesting. And, you know, the good thing about Rose Rosette, if you've ever looked at a chart of the United States and, mm-hmm. you know, like as an ink blot type of chart, it's really highly concentrated in the mm-hmm. Ohio area.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, is it our humidity? What is it?
I don't know. I've always thought it was this huge influx of mm-hmm. people planting more knockout rose right. bushes. You know, it's like you're increasing the population sure. because that particular disease has been around for some time.
Oh yeah, it's been around, but we don't see it as much in our hybrid teas, Floribundas and Grandifloras, or
right.
in the old fashioned roses. It's not as prevalent.
Yeah, I've noticed it's been more so in the knockout roses,
yes.
and a lot of times too. I don't know. You know, when I look at various situations where, let's just take a subdivision or a community where they have those really nice entrances mm-hmm. to that community, right. and they're decked out with landscaping, and a lot of times, a lot of that landscaping had incorporated the knockout rose.
Yes.
And, you know, they have companies that come in, yep. and, you know, they just go at it, they mm-hmm. put it all back, you know, they mulch everything in, and they're out the door.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of that, too, that's why I talk a lot about, you know, sanitize your pruners. And I, mm-hmm. I think that stuff gets vectored that way. You know, it's almost like, as strange as this analogy may seem or sound, it's like you certainly don't want to go to the dentist where they've
right.
used tools, mm-hmm. you know, and somebody prior to you getting in there. So you do vector things that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been proven. I mean, they will, they'll be doing some pruning, and then they'll go ahead and sample the pruning shears and put that in a petri dish. And sure enough, you've got the infection in there. So it does happen that way.
Right.
It is so difficult to, you know, I've talked to people, and they will carry a Windex like spray bottle. And they'll just have a solution of the Clorox and the water in it,
right.
And they'll spray it in between. But you know that's a lot of spraying and a lot of
it is.
But it's worth doing.
But you know, like the customer was in a store yesterday. All of her knockouts mm-hmm. had this canker
right.
on the cane stems, and she goes, "I just pruned them all back."
Right.
And I'm like, "Whoa!" You know. So yeah. Here you go. You're going from one to the other to the mm-hmm. other. And what else was interesting about that particular conversation? And we're talking about this in a break. Some of her husband's a grape growing aficionado. He's got uh-huh. grapes and a row of grapes. I don't know how many exactly. But on the ends, mm-hmm. rose bushes.
Right.
And I didn't know if there was some sort of a tie-in or correlation with that.
There, you know, that's an old, and in Europe, a lot of the old vineyards would plant a rose bush at the end of every vineyard row or at the end of every grape row. And I can't remember whether it was, there's some sort of a signal that the rose gets a certain fungus disease, and then they know to spray the grapes for this, and I'm not exactly
right.
sure what the correlation is, but there is something to that, and I just remember seeing that.
That's interesting. Well, hold on to that thought, because as we're talking about various diseases and so forth, and insects as well, this is the time of year that we're opening up some of those chemicals and various products that we've purchased at our nurseries and local garden centers. And using these products, we're going to talk about them, what they do, and we're also going to tie into the importance of the labels. We need to pay attention to the labels. Tony Works and Ernie Brown, your local home and gardening guys here at In and Around the House. We've got to take a quick break. Give us a call at 749-B105 if anything's plaguing you, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And we have David Kester with us this morning, co-hosting the show in Ernie's absence. And if you're just getting up and joining us, good morning and welcome. And go in there and just, if you haven't brewed any coffee yet, I've already had a couple myself and probably several more as we progress throughout the morning. I drink coffee all day, David. I don't know about you, but
not
man,
all day.
I'm relying on it.
I got to be honest with you. This is a little earlier than I'm accustomed to on a Saturday
really?
Morning.
Really? So you
just
get to sleep. So you get to sleep in, huh?
Well, past 5 a.m. anyway.
Wow. I know one thing. It's just I'm in bed early on a Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, I was watching a little bit of news, and all of a sudden things break out over there in the Middle East. And then I feel like I'm compelled to stay up. And so my energy level changes a little bit, and I want to tune in and see what's going on. And you know, I was kind of restless last night. Yeah. So getting up at 3:30 is when I typically get up, going on 4. It makes for a long day.
It certainly must.
So anyway, I enjoy doing it. And so that's why actually we're in our 8th year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible. I don't know where the time has gone.
It's amazing.
It is. It's crazy. And how many years have you been in the horticultural world?
Boy.
You could probably say the same thing.
At least 40. I mean, I of course, you know, gardening was a passion of mine when I was very young. And that's how I really, you know, got into it. We, when I was very young, grew raspberries in Michigan, tomatoes in Chicago, and then just evolved into it. And knew from very early on that that was always going to be a really important part of my life. So it was just a natural progression.
I've found it later in my life, which is really interesting because I came from the IT world.
Right.
And, you know, aviation as well. And I've always been around the industry as a youngster. And when I was younger, I thought to myself, I don't want to do this.
Right.
You know, so I took a different career path, and actually, you know, I've always liked horticulture and doing things in my own yard, which I don't have time to do anymore. And you can probably echo that yourself. No. I don't know. I don't want to speak for you by any means.
No, I think I could get eyesore of the week. Just my property.
I think I can beat you with that.
But someday. But you know what, Tony? It what bothers me, and what I think is unfortunate, is an awful lot of people go through their lives with gardening, and you know, it's not too far removed from our generations that a lot of people had to have a garden to feed themselves, and then all of a sudden you get to an age where you can no longer do that, and. I think one of the things that we've tried to do in Extension and really throughout the industry is to help people with raised beds and adaptable gardening tools and things like that so that they can continue to garden. And I think it's a shame. A lot of our nursing care facilities, a lot of those residents would love to be able to garden, but there just isn't any kind of opportunity for them to do that. But I think we're starting to see that change a good bit.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I'm like you. What you just said is, as I'm getting older, I still have to mow my grass. I have to put that first cut on it, and I'm dreading it. And then I'm caught up at work and all that other good stuff. And it's just like, you know, as you said, as you get older, you try to simplify those processes. And those raised beds, we're going to talk about that too, because I think it's one of the best ways to garden. If you're struggling, you can do a number of various things with raised beds. And even building certain types of beds that are up on legs.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping you off of your knees as we get a little bit older.
You know what we've, you not only, every person, you know, we do a lot of things with individuals with some special needs. And everybody's special need or disability is different. And so we try to adapt the garden to them and or so that they can continue. And every structure may have to be a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, hold on to that thought because we got to take another quick break. You're with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And again, David Kester is joining us this morning here from the Boone County Extension Office. And when we come back, we have Austin up in Goshen. He's got a question about a juniper tree. Give us a call at 749-B105. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And, I think the weather's going to be a lot different here the next couple of days than what we've seen here in the past two. We're looking at some rain today in the forecast. I heard, now don't quote me on this, and don't call me out next week on it either, because I'm not a professional weather guy. But they're saying we could possibly get 1 to 2 inches today, and that's quite a bit of moisture there. And a little bit of rain is also 90% chance of rain tomorrow in the forecast. But we'll be at 71 today, somewhere in that neighborhood. A low tonight of around 60. Tomorrow, a little cooler, 63. And then it's going to dip down into the mid-30s. And we got a couple of nights of that. So Monday's where my concerns are because we have a lot of stuff at the garden center that when you're around that freezing point, which is Monday night's low, it's a little iffy. If David, you know, when you get a low like that.
Right.
You know, it's all about, do you have cloud cover or do you not have cloud cover?
Right. But it is. And You're kind of in a at the valley. Base of a hill there, yeah. too. And, yeah, the cold will settle in there.
It gets a little dicey, that's for sure. So we have Austin with us over in Goshen. Good morning, Austin. How are you? And thanks for holding on. You there, Austin?
Yeah, yeah.
What's going on?
All it is, it's a simple one. Uh-huh. I feel like a little bit of a knucklehead. Basically, I planted this Moonglow juniper tree, and I didn't put the hole was big enough, and I didn't put it down too deep or anything, but I didn't put any peat moss in under it to get it some drainage. Do you think I should have to dig it back up to put peat moss underneath it, or do you think it might be okay where it's at? I know that anything of the juniper strand, whether it's a bonsai tree or anything, or a bush or what it is, it always needs that drainage real bad, or those roots can rot, right?
Yeah, that's a fact. Just as you stated, you know, they do need moisture when they need moisture, but on the flip side, too, a little too much is really, it could be the kiss of death over a period of time. When you dug the soil and plant your juniper, What did it appear like to you?
I mean, the soil wasn't too clay like, but I mean, it was definitely a little tougher than really rich, beautiful soil. But I put in plenty of topsoil, and I gave it some breathing room underneath, and
right.
you know, but
yeah, the breathing room underneath is not always necessarily important, and the reason being. It's because if you dig that hole too deep and you put in that loose soil, and once things get settled in, what happens is that whole root ball kind of sinks below the soil surface where it originally was. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of get that little swale, that little concave area that holds water. So always try and keep common practice when you're planting things. You know, plant things at the same depth as they come out of the container itself or the root ball. It could be B&B sometimes. But you always want to go 2 to 3 times the width of the pot, not necessarily deep. And sometimes, too, you can elevate that a little bit. You can plant it a little high and come up to it. And as you stated, do not take any soil up over the trunk, nor a mulch. That's so important. But
right.
When did you plant it?
Oh, I just planted it last week.
You know what? If it was, what's that? Was it B&B or was it a container?
It was in a container. It was like a 4.5 foot tall one.
You know what? I think that you could lift that, you know, and I would add, I wouldn't be hesitant to lift it and just do it gently. And I always recommend people to add peat moss to your existing soil. Peat moss is a wonderful product. And especially with evergreens or acid-loving plants that like a little bit of an acidic-based type of soil. And David, chime in. What do you think?
Yeah, I would make sure you blend that peat moss in with your. Don't just put it in by itself. Blend it with your whatever you're backfilling with. Mix it in really well, and don't overdo it with it. At this point, it's not going to hurt that plant at all to pull it right back out, or gently pull it back out. And redo it. It shouldn't be any problem at all.
And, you know, always use a root stimulator when you plant things. Stay away from the high nitrogen fertilizers, you know, and I'm kind of talking about the one we see in the green box.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not necessary. And, just go at it. The peat moss is a wonderful product, you know, as a soil amendment. And keep this in mind, and I want everybody to know this. We have a lot of clay here, but in all honesty, clay's not a bad thing. If we lived in Florida, I say this often, and we had all sand, you would wish like heck you had a little bit of clay. So, you know, and that's a component of the definition of soil is sand, silt, and clay for the most part. But just making clay better is the objective. And as David stated, I agree with him wholeheartedly, you know, just mix that in there evenly and fill back in, and you should be fine.
All right. Well, thank you so very much.
All right. Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
And we're going over to the Hoosier State, David, with Maria. She has a rosebush question. Good morning, Maria. How are you?
Good. How are you?
We're doing wonderful. So what can we help you with?
Well, I have 2 of 5 of my knockout roses that I know have the rose rosette, and I need to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is, is there anything I can put in the soil to prevent so I can replant?
Well, And David, feel free to chime in anytime. This is what I know, and this is what I've been told via Star Roses and Tim Wood many times. We've had this discussion. the beauty of this particular disease, it's not beautiful, but it's not soil-borne, to my knowledge. Okay. So as far as drenching things, I don't think that would necessarily be required. Okay. On the flip side, though, removal of that rose bush, getting every bit of that root out of there as possible is what's important. Because if part of that root structure, from what I understand, is still remaining in the soil, and as the new replacement, if you're going to replace it with another rose bush, mm-hmm. makes contact, if that root structure of the new rose bush makes contact with the old root system, it could pick up that particular disease.
Well, now, David, that's what happened, because I hit it with one.
Uh-huh.
I replaced the one and planted, actually, a new one next to it, and now both of them have it.
Do you think you got in all of that root structure? And it's really hard to say, you know? It's
You thought so, but apparently not.
Yeah.
This is a nasty disease. It really is. And it's a tough one. Just as Tony said, I try to get as much of it out as you can. I would also try to make that environment, bring in some organic matter and work that into the soil before you replant. And even offsetting it somewhat from where the old one was a little bit, any mm-hmm. kind of distance would help. So I'd probably do that. But, and then you may want to try to, control insects as best you can on those so that, if there's any kind of aphids and things that will move that, virus from plant to plant, that's something mm-hmm. to watch. But, it really is, it's a shame because we thought that was going to be, really a foolproof rose and, it's got its issues.
Yeah, and they were my newer roses. My older, really well established knockouts so far are fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just wondering, because I'm going to have to dig these out, and so because I mean they have so many thorns and
that's one of the identifiers.
They just don't bloom beautiful at all. You know, the blooms are just really
not
small
And just remember that them being there is a great source for moving that virus around. So,
correct.
So that's why you want to get them out of there.
Are you do you happen to live in an area that's like open space or close to a lot of woodland type situations and areas?
Actually, I don't have any woods around me, but
okay.
Yeah, we're out in the country and mm-hmm. I mean, we have neighbors next door, but I've had these established on the south side of my building for quite some time. And then the one got it. And like I said, I added a rose and replaced the one that had it. And now the two newer ones have it again.
Yeah, it's interesting because like in a rural setting or an area, you know, a lot of times this disease is vectored by the little aerified mite, if I'm saying mm-hmm. that correctly. And, you know, from the wild floribundus, you know, so the wind, this little mite just rides the wind and parks him or herself onto a rose bush, and there it is. You know, an alternative to that, to planting another knockout in that location, you know, try some of the sun-loving hydrangeas, you know, like little lime, quick fire or limelight, things like that, mm-hmm. strawberry vanilla. Those will be suitable. I'm sure you're getting at least 6 hours of sun a day, so that might be a nice alternative. So you'll have midsummer blooms on, mm-hmm. so you might want to consider something of the sort like that.
All right. Well, thank you both very much.
You're welcome, Maria. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
I will. Thank you.
Tony, I think they come out with a new hydrangea every day.
Oh,
it's amazing, isn't it?
It's incredible.
And they're all just spectacular.
Yeah, they are. Hold on to that thought. David Kester's in this morning with Ernie's absence. And if you have any questions for us, feel free to give us a call at 749-B105. We've got to take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some things that you can do to protect your rose bushes and other shrubs with various products that are available to you at the nurseries and garden centers. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And boy, we've had some beautiful days the past couple of days, and I think there's a little bit of rain in the forecast for us, unfortunately. But I know that might give me a little bit of a breather today. My dad's probably not going to want to hear that because it's been a slow month thus far, but I still need to get caught up. And, hey, there's a couple things going on today, and one of those is the McCabe Lumber Deck Expo. This is one of their biggest events of the year, and that's going on today from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Also, check out our B105 crew. We'll be there on site from noon till 2 o'clock. And there'll be a lot of manufacturers there as well on site. And they got a lot of special discounts and various things going on. So check it out. McCabe Lumber's Deck Expo. That's today from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Also, real quick, and we'll talk more about this later in the show. Next Saturday, if you don't have anything in plan, you know, in the plans for whatever's going on for you and the little ones, if you want to raise bees in your own backyard, it might be a little easier than you think. You're going to see, I can't remember her name, Justina Block is who it is. She's going to be at Burger Farms next week, the 21st, from 11 a.m. to 12:30, along with Scott Byerline from the Cincinnati Zoo, who also is going to chime in on that particular presentation and bring to you some of the pollinators that really make this happen in our backyards with our wonderful friends, the bees. So that will be going on next week at Burger Farms. That's the 21st, and that's going on during the day. We'll talk more about it later on. And David, before we went into the break, we were just talking with Maria over in Indiana a little bit about her knockout rose bush. But just rose bushes in general, you brought up something very interesting. You know, aphids love the rose bushes. The sawfly gets on their laser eggs, right. And you got the rose slug there, and you know, these sucking insects. What are some of your go-to approaches for taking care of those issues?
Well, I, you know, we've really had pretty good luck with some of the systemics that for insects on roses. I, if you're not necessarily knockouts, but some of the more the hybrid teas, floribundas, grandifloras, those kinds that people are really managing intensely, the systemics can be a great way to go. And I think obviously you've got to worry about black spot with those, so you're going to go with some sprays for those, as well as I've heard good reports on even some of the systemic fungicide for that one. But they're great products, and they keep you from, you know, introducing a lot of that into the air and things like that. So, but I think it's a balanced approach. You can't use any one thing constantly with roses. It's the same way in fruit trees. You've got to give them something else, break it up a little bit.
Right.
And that seems to be the best approach.
Yeah. I found the systemics to work the best.
Yeah.
And I lean towards those products that are water soluble that you can mix up. And it gets into the plant quicker via its root structure, and it's therefore, once it gets into the root structure, it's taken up into the plant and protects it for up to a year.
Right.
And we talk often here about Fertilume Systemic Tree and Shrub Drench, which is a wonderful product, and that does the trick. It really keeps your rose bushes looking nice all year long from insect damage. But on the flip side, you know, rose bushes are typically heavy feeders, so you need to fertilize them monthly as well.
Yeah, it's... That is one that, you know, we maybe take a little bit off in the heat of the summer. But to me, in this area, I love the fall roses when they come in September. That seems to be when I get my best roses out of the whole year. I mean, you're going to get them very soon, and then you have a little kind of a summer slump, and then you go back into them pretty heavy. And I like to really, you know, again, hit them with fertilizer in August. And then, but as you said... all the way through there, and then of course ample water during the season.
Right.
Give them that, and try to keep the foliage dry if you can. That helps, especially going into the evening, overnight hours. Roses are tough, as you know, and but you know it's still they claim it's the America's favorite flower.
I have to agree with that. It wasn't mine at one time because I thought to myself, you know, when I was younger, I mean, there's a lot of work with these guys. But really, I think when you understand the dynamics of things that go on and why, I think it simplifies it a lot. It did for me anyway. And like you said, I agree with you. Once you get into the summer months, you know, things kind of, they slow down. You know, rose bushes like cooler temperatures, and that's when they perform at their best. And have you ever been hesitant to cut back into a rose bush a second time and you know, cut it back and get it to rejuvenate itself for later?
No, you know, because honestly, when the Japanese beetles arrive, we like to cut our roses as soon as they start to show color, and we bring them in the house and use the blooms inside, because any of that color out there attracts Japanese beetles. So we'll cut them and bring them in. But I'm constantly cutting on mine, and I like to open them up again and keep air movement in there.
Right.
So, yeah, and you can do that if you've got the nutrition down, you've got them well sprayed, and you're pushing growth with moisture and
right.
and fertility, you can get away with doing that.
Yeah, you know, and going back to the sprays, particular fungicides, you know, what do you typically like to use? You know, I know chlorothalonil is a good one for rose bushes. Another name, Dakinil.
Yeah. I use some things that I get from Rosemania. It's mm-hmm. a company in Tennessee, and there's some products that they have that are a little bit. Heritage is one. I think there's one called Compass. Banner Max is another one. All those are kind of some that I will go with. But you know, Funginex. I know that there's various ones, and it's again, Tony, you can't just say I'm going to spray my roses every week. You've got to really look at the weather. If it's been cold and wet and rainy,
right,
you may have to do more than that.
Will you approach it from the standpoint before it rains with the spray like the grape growers do?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, so like it coats the foliage.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of these chlorothalonil, It has that kind of a milky,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the rose growers don't like that on their foliage.
Because they don't look as nice.
Yeah, they
right.
don't look as nice. So a lot of the rose sprays are kind of a clear when they go on. You can certainly smell them mm-hmm. when they go on, but, mm-hmm. but they go on and they don't show anything on the foliage. And that's what a lot of them prefer.
Yeah, and you know, roses are beautiful. There's so many different varieties. And this year it seems as if, you know, we'll grow roses early. And yeah, Julia Child's been the one of the most right. sought after yeah. here just recently, and I understand it's a great performer. And when I was out on the West Coast with my wife last year vacationing, we were out in Oregon and had stopped at some various gardens and mm-hmm. botanical gardens. Gosh, you know, the rose bushes out there are just so lush. The foliage is totally different than what we're accustomed to yeah. seeing here.
Yeah, it really is amazing. And of course, there's the American Rose Association, which is really a phenomenal group, and they have a membership and a wonderful magazine that they send out monthly. And then, of course, right here in Cincinnati, we've got a Rose Society, and they mm-hmm. meet, and they also put on a show where if you're not a competitive member, you can go and you can kind of take a look at some of the roses and really mm-hmm. get to talk to the growers. It really makes a big difference. When I got into it, I had so much help from. We actually had a Northern Kentucky Rose Growers Association, and those people said, you know, you really this Pristine was a rose that they really recommended to me, and I've had Pristine for years. I've had Oklahoma, and mm-hmm. you know, just some of the those that they had success with,
right.
and so I stuck with those.
You know, there's a gentleman that comes into the store often. I can't think of his last name, but he used to be part of the Northern Kentucky mm-hmm. Rose Society. I think they went. Did they not just recently
yes.
merge with?
They did. Well, not recently, but yeah, that membership merged with Cincinnati.
Right. That's what I thought. Paul, you know, I can't remember his last name.
Mm.
If it comes to me, it's a great, great guy.
Uh-huh.
You know, he wants to introduce me to a couple of people, and uh-huh. he's just a rose fanatic.
Yeah.
When he comes in, he's always looking at the roses.
Right.
You know, Tony, these
right.
look nice. These look nice. I just wish I had more room.
Yeah.
But there are some serious rose growers out there.
Campbell County, of course, has a great bed right outside the gardens there. And Ray Richardson is just a phenomenal rose grower. He's consulted, and he's actually does a lot of the maintenance and mm-hmm. helps with the ones in Campbell County. And they've got a really nice display.
You guys had I love the beds behind that facility.
Yeah,
were you part of all that whole design and setup? I'll pat you on the back.
That was a great project, and I people told me that would be I'd be miserable because it would be the most hectic time of my life. But we worked with professionals, Human Nature, and we had a great construction company and. Jeffrey Allen Corporation did the work, and it just worked out really well. And you know, those beds they're all irrigated and just super soil in there, and
mm-hmm.
just a great place to visit.
Yeah, no, I found that to just be a wonderful little place just to go strolling through,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the real element that comes into play for me at that particular facility we're talking about over at the Campbell County Extension Office. Are the raised beds,
yeah.
you know, and let's talk about raised beds when we come back out of the break, because That's a wonderful way to garden, especially if you're growing root vegetables as well. Give us a call at 749-B105. Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. We've got to take another quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And before we went into the break, we were just talking about the beautiful raised beds that you can just take a nice leisurely stroll through over there at the Campbell County Extension behind the facility itself. And I can't emphasize this enough, David. I think it's one of the best ways to garden.
I do too, and it's just got a lot of benefits. It takes some work to improve the soil that you put into the raised beds. You have one opportunity to do it right and to bring in some organic matter, some compost, well rotted animal manures, things like that. Blend that in there, and then of course you've got to maintain it, which. If it's for vegetables, you add to it every year. Mm-hmm. I never stop adding compost to it. I even will cover crop raised beds in my garden. I'll put some winter wheat or rye in there, mm-hmm. and turn those in. But to me the thing about raised beds that I absolutely love is at this time of year when we're getting so much rain, my beds are no more than 4 feet wide. And I can maintain them and work in them without stepping in them. And
right.
That's a great benefit. So I can do all that from outside. And also a great benefit is that they drain so well.
Right.
At this time of year, this is what you want. And so I can get in there. And, today I'm here. But when I get off of here, even if it's raining, I'm going to go out and I'm going to plant some onions today. I think I can probably get some potatoes in the ground today, and I could never, and snow peas. I just love
right.
snow peas, and that's always an issue that I can never get them planted early enough. And when I've got a raised bed, I can do that. And of course, the other thing is, back in August when it's hot and dry, that super drainage that you have in there is not as mm-hmm. big a benefit.
Right.
So you've got to supplement water more with a raised bed, but I still think they're just great to have.
When you start out with a raised bed and you're trying to determine what type of soil mixtures are really going to best suit your needs and come mm-hmm. into play, do you have a generic kind of go-to recipe and then you alter it, a little more salt, a little more pepper?
Yeah, absolutely.
What is that, like a third of?
It is. It really is. And I was really lucky in that my garden had great soil to begin with. So. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to, when the roots go down into my native soil, I'm not all that uncomfortable with that because
right.
it's great stuff. But I do now, Tony, one of the things that I like to do is I love to grow carrots and,
right.
Carrots don't do well in our clay soils. So I will, we always recommend to people not to add sand to their soils. This is one exception. I have a couple of raised beds that are exclusively for root crops, and I will have a mixture of sand in those,
mm-hmm.
and those roots can go really deep, and I can get, the long carrots. I still grow mainly the shorter type carrots, but beets, any kind of the root crops, turnips, things like that, mm-hmm. they do really well in it, and just a nice, soft, loose soil, and they can go and you get the kind of things that you see at the store.
Right. I love turnips. There was a gentleman that grew turnips up there in Taylor Mill, and we would always use some of those pine trees behind Allison mm-hmm. Rose's funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
And we would cut some pine, and the guy next to the funeral home had turnips, and we would just dig those out. I tell you what, you just peel that back, eat it, eat that like a potato, a little salt on
mm-hmm.
it. I think of that all the time.
Yeah.
The root vegetables, I would always struggle with beets.
Yeah.
And it might be because just that. So is that, would you use that same bed?
I do. And beets, I had a, when I, we lived in Louisville, we had an old individual from the country who lived next to us. And he was the best gardener that I ever knew. And he showed me a trick one time. He said, when I plant beets, I will put a board over the top of the row. And he said, it just seems it makes sense because he would create a little bit a dark environment, but also it would be constantly moist under there. And he would put that on there. And then when he saw the beet begin to germinate, he would take the board off, and he got great germination, got full rows, and it was just a trick that he showed me.
Interesting. What about what would cause this? I've had people ask me this often, and you know, I always think about you know the soil condition, how easily it is for the root vegetable to permeate it,
mm-hmm.
or you know, grow into it, I should say. You know, radish is not really producing the radish. Is there a reason behind that?
I think the number one reason is that you haven't thinned them enough. They're not far enough apart. And it's the same thing with carrots and beets and all of them. It drives me crazy because I love full rows. I don't like so I will constantly overseed, and it's a big mistake because you're throwing out way over the amount of seed that you put in the ground because you have to thin them out. So, but those roots vegetables need space, and you know the radishes need to be an inch at least apart
right.
in the row. And beets, of course, more so, depending on the size that you want to mm-hmm. use them as. So you've got to give those things a little bit of space. And if you overseed it like I do, you've got to go in there and thin them.
Thin it out, right. Yeah, that's important to do. And right now, too, you were talking about planting potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and typically people like to do that in March. So you feel that we're not really too late based on what we've had with the weather. So I think this is a perfect example of, you can't always go by calendar date. Yeah,
really can't. And I would have loved to have had mine in. But then, you know, we've had some really cold temperatures, some night temperatures. And potatoes, they would have been fine. I would have liked to have had those in by now. And they've been able to handle that cold. Mm-hmm. But it's time to get them in the ground. And I will be doing that hopefully today. But, Tony, I love to grow some of the ones that you can't find, like the French fingerlings,
right.
the blue and the purple ones, kids love those. And it's just it's a neat vegetable to for kids because it's kind of like digging for buried treasure down there. There's potatoes under the ground, which
right.
kind of amazes people.
See, I wish I could do that and had more space. What I do, mm-hmm. I go to Madison's over at Finley and pick those up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Keep that in mind because I want to ask you, like, what is your process, you know, as you're growing potatoes? People do various things. And we got to take another quick break. 749-B105, Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And thank you for tuning in there with us this morning. And obviously, Ernie is out. And in Ernie's absence, we have David Kester from the Boone County Extension Office with us. Hang in there with us. When we come back, we're going to talk more about potatoes. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And boy, you know, doesn't look too bad out there now, a little overcast, but there's definitely some rain in the forecast for later today. They're calling for possibly 1 to 2 inches of rain, and also there's a great chance of rain tomorrow. But today's high around 70, 71, with a low tonight of 60, not too bad, kind of comfortable. You might need to need to do some things indoors today if we get that kind of rain. Now, I know David said he's going to get out and plant potatoes and onions and so forth. What are you going to do? Put on your trench coat and your galoshes and all that good stuff.
Little rain won't hurt you.
And, no, not at all.
And, my dogs, they don't mind the rain. They'll go with me, so we'll be good.
Come in with muddy paws, muddy shoes, all that good stuff,
yeah.
right? And your wife, David, you really have to do that? Yeah, you know, you're going to make me clean all this up?
That is a problem.
I hear it all the time, you know, especially with lawns and people who have dogs, and
mm-hmm.
you know they have paths, and they're fed up with cleaning their paws and always mopping the kitchen. So
this is a bad time of year for them.
Oh yes, it is. So we were talking about potatoes, and are you the type of potato grower that, as your potatoes grow, you continue to mound them?
I have done both, and I think I'm going back to mounding, and it's a little bit more labor. But I really think it makes a difference because the potato will continue to send out more tubers
mm-hmm.
up that stem. So if you do that, you will find that you'll have potatoes deep and as well as at the surface. So I'm going to probably do that. I used to just create a little furrow, put soil over the top of that,
mm-hmm.
and then put straw, really deep straw over the top of that. But I think I'm going to go back and I'm going to actually
do it the old conventional way.
And do that. I think I'll get more yield out of it. And, you know, when you're doing with raised beds and you're talking about potatoes because, you know, potatoes are not real expensive to buy at the store. No. But so you have to kind of want, you know, maybe some of the specialty potatoes, which I do. But I don't want to dedicate a lot of space to them, a lot of my raised beds. So
right.
I'll just do a couple, but I want to maximize production out of those.
You know, I've heard of people growing those in tires.
Yeah.
And just, you know, and filling it up as it grows.
I saw a grower who grew them in a straw bale. And actually, you know, they had the bale seasoned and they went in there. And when they harvested, they just cut the twine on the bale and the potatoes just rolled out.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because we had a little phone-in interview with a gentleman who, I can't remember his name, I think it was Dale, and I don't remember his last name, I'm sorry about that, but he authored a book on straw bale gardening, and I tried it, you know, and I don't know if I had seasoned my bale quite right. where it needed to be, you know, I was using Milorganite, as a matter of fact, when I was seasoning the bale, grew peppers in it okay. Tomato plants, a couple of them were just okay there. The peppers did the best.
Right.
And we also tried, what I want to call it, we were doing potatoes in a metal kind of cage where we layered it with, you know, we started out with soil, then we did straw, soil and straw. And that was okay, too, because I think we did that a little too late in the season, but you could tell they were growing. But take me to this world. You just had a class with this as well, did you not?
We did. And we you know, showed people how to season the bale and do the whole thing. And, you know, the bales are $7-$8 a bale at your garden center or hardware store. Or, you know, if you can find a feed store, they may be a little bit less than that. But really simple way to grow things if you don't have the room. And, of course, when you're finished with it, that straw can be used as a mulch or incorporated into your soil, which, of course, is a tremendous benefit. But we had the class, and it was back in February, and we told people how to season the bale. Well, part of that seasoning depends on sun and some warmer temperatures, which we haven't had. And the bales have not really seasoned or begun to decompose.
Right.
And so it's been a very slow process to get them to work this year.
Yeah, I know that. I'm trying to remember the process that I had taken to, you know, season the bale. I was using Milorganite. I think I watered it every couple of days. Right. You know, you're trying to let it heat up. You want that to decompose a little bit. And I don't know if it was quite ready when I had started that or not. Right. And I should give it another shot. But it is an interesting concept, to say the least. I know that I've seen people run like drip lines along those. It's easy if you're growing tomatoes in them. You can put a tomato stake right down in it and it holds it up well enough. There's a lot of interesting things you can do.
Yeah, you've got to continue to fertilize that bale throughout the summer because it doesn't have the you know the natural fertility of the soil.
Right.
So you've got to do that, and then of course the seasoning is adding fertilizer to the top, and then adding some soil and good soil is into that as well.
When you know, speaking of fertilizers, when you're fertilizing, especially vegetables, things that you're consuming. Where do you lean towards? Are you on the organic side?
I do because I have really been able to find sources of it. I think we've got several really good organic fertilizers around. I tend to really like the Nature Safe, and that's one that used to be made by Griffin Industries right there in Campbell County was their headquarters. And now it's been purchased by somebody else. But and I understand a lot of golf courses use the Nature Safe fertilizers, and they're pretty good. And then, but there's just an awful lot of them out there now, and they're delivering the nutrients, and you know they're good products.
Yeah, I'm starting to see a lot more people gravitating towards the organic approach. You know, especially when they're growing their own edibles and so forth. You know, guys, it's hard to tell, and no one will ever know what you buy, where it comes from. Right. So I think that's so important.
Sure.
And taking that back to your raised beds, back to straw bale gardening, even some of the, you know, just planters or patio deck planters where you can just, you know, garden a little bit.
Yeah.
Nothing beats you know, just going right out into the garden and picking something fresh.
No, it's fun. I've always enjoyed that. And, just tremendous. But, you know, when you talk about the containers and stuff, Tony, and I know that you get into this a lot with the baskets and everything else. I really, this time of year, people will go out and they'll buy a container, and what they fill that with is just critical, as you know. If you go out and you put native soil in it, you are setting yourself up for, I think, some really disappointing results. I think all the bad properties of our native soil are magnified when you put them in a pot, and you really need to spend the money on a potting mix,
right,
which aren't cheap, I'll admit, but yet their benefits are just tenfold over.
And, you know, using a good potting medium is so important. And here's the other element, too. I say this often to people. Don't discard it to next year. Right. Only if, in fact, you have some disease issues. Mm-hmm. Then there's some concerns. But if things did relatively well, no disease issues, certainly just add to it. Right. You know, replenish it with other, mm-hmm. you know, with that same type of soil mix that you've been working with.
Right.
It's a great way to garden. And, you know, we used to sell a fair amount of the earth boxes.
Uh-huh.
Those are awesome. I've gone as far as I've grown garlic in earth boxes, in the fall. It's just so many things that you can do. And there's a lot of young people in the Cincinnati area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing them coming into the garden center.
Right.
They're interested in gardening to a degree. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of us think that millennials aren't. But their living environments, there's more constraints. You know, they have balconies. They're living downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly they're gravitating towards the container gardening on their balconies. And going back to that soil medium that you're talking about, you know, that is so, so important. And I see people want to buy on price.
Right.
And that is the worst thing that you can do. Yeah. You know, when you buy a 99-cent bag of topsoil or potting soil, you're going to get that kind of performance from it.
That's exactly right. It's, you know, that's the cheap way to go, but it's just not going to deliver the results. We, you know, if it says soil or the bag manure, those products have their place, but not in a pot. You really are looking for the word mix, and it should be potting mix, which is going to be a blend of, as you know, peat moss and maybe some pine bark and possibly it'll have some,
a little wetting agent with a little perlite, a little vermiculite.
And those, the light mixes. And you know, it also will be a whole lot lighter for you to move around. If you're moving those pots around, it'll be it won't be quite as heavy, but they'll retain moisture. They'll give you drainage and they'll also give you performance.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I was just talking to someone yesterday, a younger customer, and she's wanting to grow tomatoes in containers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need a pot with substance to it.
Yes.
That's so important.
You do.
You know, tomatoes, if they're indeterminate, you know, they can get some height to them. You need to stake them. They could easily tip that container over.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of variables that you need to take into consideration doing this. And, but I enjoy seeing young people getting into the gardening scene.
Right.
And I'm seeing more and more of it. And I'm seeing more of the younger families coming in as couples with kids on strollers, you know, they're looking for that organic approach. Right. Herbs are big right now with the young kids. The succulents are still big.
Mm-hmm.
It's neat and it's encouraging to see that. And I hope that continues.
Sure.
But, you know, talking about container gardening, so forth, let's talk about some of our favorite tomatoes and what we can do to get really good tomatoes. That's what we're all racing for this time of year. 749-B105, Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. If you have any questions, whatever's plaguing you in the garden, although we're talking about vegetables, we can talk about anything that you desire. 749-B105, we'll be right back. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie. Your local home and gardening guys, and you know, we've covered a lot of ground this morning. We've been all over the board, so to speak, in a good way. You know, we talked a little bit about straw gardening, straw bale gardening, and some raised bed gardening and so forth, and with containers. And along those lines, I mean, this time of year, a lot of people are coming into the garden center, David, and they're wanting to race for that very first tomato. And I have a lot of things to add to that. And one of those is, once you put something like that into the ground, when it's coming from a controlled environment in a greenhouse, and into the soil conditions and temperatures that are a lot cooler and that not what it's accustomed to, I think that's detrimental. It's not favorable, I should say. Maybe not detrimental, but not favorable for that particular plant. So, you know, when it comes to getting that first tomato, you know, that's so important for guys to brag about. Are you one of those by chance, or do you just go at it at your own pace?
I have rarely planted before May 1st. Sometimes if I look at the weather, the forecast is maybe for temperatures in the 80s at the last week of April. I will cheat a little bit and I'll go then. But as you said, it's the soil temperature's got to be up, and a lot of times you can think that you're doing well by getting them in early, but they'll just sit there. They won't start to grow, and you'll see maybe a little purpling on the foliage.
Which
is a temporary phosphorus deficiency, which they just can't take up phosphorus when it's that cold out, and so it's you're not helping yourself, or you're not getting any earliness by doing that. But yeah, there's things that you can do with plastic. You can heat up the soil a little bit with that. You can put tents around them, things like that. But some of those first tomatoes, they don't have quite the taste that I think that the ones that are just grown one at the right time of the year have. So I
agree with that. The taste is not quite there yet because the temperatures aren't quite there yet. And, and along those lines, what I'll find myself doing is early on, if I see blooms coming on a tomato plant a little early or prematurely, I'm like, nah, I'm pinching you out. And I'm going to let you get a little bit more strength.
Sure.
And, talking about pinching out, what do you talk about? Are you a tomato pruner?
I will sucker the tomatoes initially
in the axils right there.
Yes, at beginning, because I don't really like a lot of low foliage on my tomatoes because that's where I get diseases to start.
Mm-hmm.
So I will go ahead and sucker those, and I'll even remove some of the lower limbs or branches off of those and get them up in the air a little bit, because when you get rainfall and it's hitting that soil and it's bouncing those spores, the fungal spores up, that's where early blight will get started. And boy, there's nothing that'll take your tomato plants down quicker than that will. So I do mulch with my tomatoes because I want to reduce that splashing. But those are all things that, you just methods to go about it. But early blight is by far our worst disease on tomatoes.
Oh, big time. And some years it's worse than others.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and it's important too to rotate those. Don't always plant your tomato plants in the same area. And I know a lot of us cheat, and we do.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to what you just said, I like to, the raised beds, this is a great way to mulch them. I like to use layers of newspaper. I'll moisten it about three or four or five sheets.
Right.
And then top it off with a little bit of straw, and I find that works really, really well. And it keeps weeds at bay, it keeps the soil temperatures kind of even and cooler, helps with moisture retention. And most importantly, what you said, when you're planting tomatoes in the same place and, those hard rains pelt the soil surface and get those spores moving, it's amazing how that works from the bottom up.
It's when you get the infection taking place early in the season down on those lower leaves. I mean, it's just you're going to be lucky to get through the month of July with foliage on your plants.
And this is an interesting observation on my part. I always hear where people start a tomato plant for the very first time, and it's in a bed for the first time, the yield's a bumper yield. So there's not all those other issues that are associated with using the same bed repeatedly year after year. Right. So don't you find that so?
And one of the, with raised beds, you can't rotate as much as maybe you want to. So, and I think organic matter can be a great advantage to you if you will keep replenishing it. And as this, the new season starts, add a 2-inch layer of organic matter to the top, maybe work that in. And that can really offset some of those problems, not all by any means, but it can help.
Last year, usually I don't get my tomatoes in until maybe the last 2 weeks of May, maybe around the beginning of June. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But I know the soil temperatures are where they need to be at that point in time. You know, and also peppers, too. That's even more important. You know, peppers do not like cool soil situations.
Peppers even more so than tomatoes. They just won't tolerate it.
Trying to get that early jump's not always the best thing. Right. And, you know, let's talk about some staking approaches with tomatoes. Do you have anything that you do that's a favorite? Do you use the road mesh that they use for concrete reinforcement?
I use concrete reinforcing wire, and it works for me. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's practical for everybody because you have to live with that cage. You cannot unfold it. If you break the wires, so you have to live with that big cage. And if you're in a subdivision, it's not the prettiest thing to have stored around the house. I live out in the country, so I have those, and I have just built them over the years, and I can get 10 to 12 years out of a cage. And so, I get the cage on the plant, and that's the last time I have to touch it. I may come back and do the suckering, but once you have a cage on there, it's fine. And I have rarely seen cages that you can purchase that are as good as the concrete reinforcing wire ones. They're just tough, and they work. And there's plans for those on all the
right.
And of course, you know, they're honestly dangerous to make because you really need to have safety goggles on when you're cutting that wire because it will fly back at you. And you also it's very heavy to buy at Lowe's or Home Depot or wherever you get it. You have to buy a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I use, and I've been using them for years. I like the height that you get.
Yes.
Now, I will tell you this. Recently, we've been selling, and I never thought I would sell a tomato cage like this because they're not cheap, but they are heavy-duty galvanized folding cages.
They're
square and round, and you talk about easy storage, going back to what you're saying.
That's that would be a good one to be. Because, you know, the ones that you usually buy are too short, and they're just not strong enough.
They're junk.
Yeah.
Everybody comes in, they want the $1.99 tomato cage. You know, get over that. Yeah. I don't mean that to sound bad. You know, you're investing in something.
Exactly.
Your time. Typically, those indeterminate tomatoes, when we talk about indeterminates versus determinants, indeterminate tomato plants can get various heights, whatever they want to grow to.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take those small cages right over, or what happens? It all of a sudden flops, and then you got that kink in the stem, and it's just not worth it, in my opinion.
And once you try to straighten that back up, you've got to use a bunch of stakes, and you might as well just stake them to begin with.
Yeah. Sometime if you're down at the store, I have to show you these folding galvanized.
Yeah, I'd like to see them.
They're really nice, and I have a couple people that have been coming in repeatedly, buying just a few at a time. But I'm very impressed with it.
Yeah.
Nor did I ever think I would sell a tomato cage. I mean, they're not cheap.
Right.
But this is an investment for the long run.
Sure.
Keep that thought in mind. And also, we're going to talk about some of our favorite tomatoes and what are good fertilizers for your tomatoes. How to get that best tomato so you can enjoy that BLT sandwich. 749-B105, Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And we've been discussing tomatoes, and we're going to tell you some of our favorites. And it's just that time of year, and nothing better than a fresh-picked tomato, amongst other things in the vegetable garden as well. Don't count out the cucumbers and so forth, but you know, just those tasty tomatoes, that, you know, that juicy pulp. I don't know about you, David, but I like the pulp. I know a lot of people like the thick, meaty ones, but
I go towards more of the meaty ones. And I, you know, when it's tomato season, we can breakfast, lunch, dinner. They're always on the table. I've got to have tomatoes.
You have any favorites?
I do. They're favorites because first they deliver taste, and that's of course the biggest priority. But secondly, I really do like to have some disease resistance in my tomatoes. And Celebrity, I think, is still a great tomato. It yields extremely well, and it's got disease resistance. I think the Big Beef is a really good tomato. I think it's got great taste, and it's sizable disease resistance. One of the heirlooms that I kind of like is German Johnson. I think that's a nice tomato, and I really do like Brandywine, but I
too late for me.
I'll just tell people, you know, since I have a large garden, I have space for Brandywine. If I had a small garden, Brandywine would not be in my garden, because if I get 4 or 5 tomatoes off of a Brandywine plant, I've done really well for the year. It just doesn't yield.
No, it's a little tough too, and it's a different type of foliage.
Yeah.
Almost looks like a potato
leaf. Yes. Yeah.
But very tasty.
It is.
They're unbeatable.
Yeah.
But for me, it's too long.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I'm planting late, it really takes me late.
Yeah, it does.
And a lot of things can happen in between when I plant and when that thing's ready. So I agree with you. Celebrity is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. It really is, you know, especially for disease resistance.
Right.
Oddly enough, and you might, I don't know if you'll believe this or not, last year I picked a ripe Celebrity tomato out of a raised bed by July 4th.
Wow.
That's
very good.
That's true. Yeah. And it was, I just had like a little raised bed there behind the garden center.
Yeah.
And that's just where I placed it. But the soil was warm enough, again, going into that raised bed.
You had a microclimate there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it did well.
For earliness, I still think Early Girl is a great tomato.
Mm-hmm.
It has good taste for an early tomato.
Mm-hmm.
I don't plant a lot of them in the garden, but I always have a few just to get an earlier tomato.
You know, I like, I was just telling you in the break, Green Zebra.
Uh-huh.
It has a real distinctive taste to it. I kind of like the tartness.
Yeah, a lot of people tomatoes. Do like that tomato.
Yeah.
It's a popular one.
Very good tomato. I like it a lot. You know, and I also, you know, I ever since like the introduction like of the Black Creme.
Right.
That's one of those tomatoes. It's really red, but it's green on top and it has a blackish appearance.
Yes.
I've always leaned in that arena for some time, you know, Cherokee Purple, Black Creme, Black Russian, those various types. And you said another one, too, Sun Sugar, that little yellow cherry-type tomato. Gosh.
That's really becoming popular with everybody. It's really tough to find the seed sometime of that one. I used to have a one that I liked, a cherry tomato called Sweet Baby Girl.
Never tried it.
It was, and you can still find the seed for it, but I just thought that was a really nice, and it had disease resistance again, and just real good taste.
Do you have a special soil blend for tomatoes if you do them in a container?
Oh, in a container, I really like to do, if I'm mixing it myself, I do the third native soil, a third peat moss, and a third maybe some perlite or vermiculite in there. And possibly a little bit of well-rotted compost, manure, things like that in there. And really, if I have really good compost, I'll cut back on the peat moss and add more of the compost to it.
You know, I've had great success with some of the Fox Farm soils.
Uh-huh.
One in particular, Happy Frog.
Okay.
We saw a lot of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the texture of it, you know, it's got a little perlite in it. Right. You know, it has earthworm castings in it, mycorrhiza.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with a book called, it's going to come to me. It's about soil.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the, all the components of soil and all these important elements in the top part of it with the mycorrhiza.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like mycorrhiza is a very important part of a plant's overall health.
Right.
I know we're still probably, you know, I know there's not a lot known about mycorrhiza, but I think there's some key elements that we know that it plays an important part of the success of a lot of plants.
Right.
What's your take with that? Have you ever used it?
I use it a lot in, with the potting mixes that I have and, you know, the mycorrhiza, the mycorrhiza will grow and proliferate more in an organic soil than it will in a clay soil. So if you're adding a lot of organic matter and mycorrhiza, you're probably going to maintain that and it will stay available or and in the soil, and of course it facilitates nutrient availability to the plants.
But I've had great success with the Happy Frog.
And
I like to use. I don't know if you're familiar. If you remember Monty's Joy Juice,
yeah, sure.
It's hard to get your hands on anymore, and it's not called Monty's Joy Juice. They call it, you know, Monty's Plant Food, and they were really trying to get a foothold into, you know, just like the everyday market,
right?
Like the other fertilizers. And just not with a great deal of success. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're located down in Louisville, Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, did you ever meet Monty?
I don't think so. I've his picture used to be on the package.
Yes, yes. He was a character. Okay. Boy, you couldn't get away from him either. Uh-huh. Once you started talking with Monty, it's like, okay, I got to go. I got to go. But great guy. But I understand that he developed that particular fertilizer originally for rose bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the analysis of it, I think it's an 8-16-8, mm-hmm. very subdued, easy to use.
Right.
I've had a great deal of success with it. And also, they came out with a calcium mixture.
Ah.
And when I would use those in combination mm-hmm. with various things, I would just, one year, we grew these cherry tomatoes in containers around the garden. So they were just gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just knocked down gorgeous, right. loaded with tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And everybody has their own recipe for
sure,
success.
Sure. Now, I've heard of all kinds. You know, some people put a match, you know, they'll burn the match and they'll put that in there. I've heard of adding milk and just a lot of things. But it's really, you know, a good soil is where you're going with it. And just that it'll provide all the things that the tomato needs.
Yeah, and eggshells. You'll hear people
right,
use eggshells.
Right.
I'm trying to think. What was the other thing I wanted to ask you? Have you heard of this? Not to switch gears or change mm-hmm. the subject matter. I have heard people taking a piece of a potato and putting underneath is it a rose bush?
Have
you ever heard of that?
Yeah.
And I don't know what that, I didn't know what that did, but, does.
The potato won't grow under there if it's that deep, and so I mean I the only thing I could think of is it would decay and the rose would feed off of that.
It's something like that. It was really bizarre. Mm-hmm. And maybe I hope I didn't blow that my wife tells me I have a way of distorting some things. That might have been a little distorted right there, but it was something of the sort. Yeah, so it was just bizarre.
There's a lot of things like that.
And when you said the matchstick, that's
a very common old was putting rock salt on your asparagus bed in the spring of the year, and that was actually the rock salt would kill the weeds, but it wouldn't apparently kill or hurt the asparagus. However, any kind of salt is going to kill roots, and it will damage the
right.
asparagus roots. But it was actually used as a herbicide.
Really?
Yeah,
that's interesting. I just like those old kind of wives' tales, or if mm-hmm. they really work. Well, hold on to those thoughts. When we come back, we're still going to talk about the edibles in the garden. Let's talk a little bit about some strawberries and so forth. And I know you're an avid fan of the brambles, the mm-hmm. the blackberries, the raspberries, and all that good stuff. 749-B105, Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And if you're just joining us, there's a lot of interesting things yet to come up with David Kester, the extension agent out at Boone County. And we're going to talk everything vegetable and gardening. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And right there before we went into the break, I was talking about I've heard people putting a piece of a potato underneath a rose bush when they plant a rose bush. And I kind of researched that. I wasn't quite sure, but I think I know where that comes from. I understand what I see as some people would start a rose cutting in mm-hmm. a potato, which I find very interesting. And you were talking about willow water.
Yeah, there's
that's
an
interesting
you
one.
Can... it's an old remedy, or not a remedy, but a something that'll assist you in propagating plants. But you can somehow seep the willow stems in water, and then use that water to water something that you're trying to get to root, or maybe even get it to root in that water. I'm not really sure the whole thing, but there's actually a little bit of research that does support that.
You know, I like those kind of things. You know, there's interesting remedies and approaches to various ways to propagate plants and so mm-hmm. forth. And if anyone has anything interesting or that your grandfather, your grandmother used to do, I'd certainly love to hear it, because I always like those old stories, you know, how people did things back in the day, especially.
Right.
And, you know, before we went into the break, we were talking about various things, and I want to talk about strawberry plants. I know that you like strawberries. I've been to one of your presentations with strawberries and so forth, and I know you love, the blackberries and all that good mm-hmm. stuff. And I think is that where most of your expertise is? When you were growing up, were in the light of the...
Yeah, it was an interest, so I've been following it and trying to grow some, and I've... I've really got to get back into it. I'm hoping that, you know, with maybe retirement in the future, that I can spend a good bit of time doing that.
Well, you've already retired once. We're back at it again. You just couldn't get enough of it. So, you know, strawberry plants, a lot of people love strawberries. And, oh, gosh, especially in the summer months, yes. You just pick a strawberry and, like, boom.
Right.
It's a taste like none other. You know, I want to talk about something I think a lot of people throw around with various terms or are not quite sure what these terms mean. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the June bears.
Right.
We also have the day neutrals and the ever bears.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about that because, like, June bears produce fruit, you know, all at once.
The end of May, 1st of June is when they're going to come out. But now is when we are planting the June berries, berry strawberries. You're getting them at the your garden centers now, and you're putting them in. That what a lot of people don't realize is that you really shouldn't let them fruit this year. You've got to kind of, you want them to grow vegetatively, but if they have flowers on them, you need to pick those off. We really want them to grow vegetatively for 1 year, produce a good root system and a lot of stems, and then we fruit them a year from now. And that's, it's kind of that delayed gratification that a lot of us aren't used to. When we put something in the ground, we expect something out of it right away, and you don't get that with those, or you shouldn't.
Right.
It'll kind of weaken that plant. The other thing is with the day neutrals and the ever-bearing, is that with ever-bearing strawberries, you can get them to fruit this year.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go ahead and plant those in the ground, and there's a one that I've grown a good bit is Seascape, and that's just an excellent ever-bearing strawberry. And you do want to pick the blooms off for maybe a month or so and let that plant get established, and then you can let it go, and you'll start to get some fruit off of it. Now, you're not going to get that gigantic harvest that you do out of the June bearing at the 1st of June.
Yeah, it's sporadic. And
it is.
Also, is the fruit not a little smaller
sometimes?
It's a
little smaller, but the quality is there.
Yeah, right.
It really is.
You know, I'm like you. When I tell people that are buying strawberries, you know, you got to look at it as, you know, something you want to set up the stage for next year and the following year. And I would tell them, you know, I do my best to pinch out the bloom buds and get those runners so you can peg those down and get those as future generations as well. And then that second year, it's like, boom, you got that bumper crop.
Right.
And that's when you can do the jams and various things.
Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, the strawberries do require some work. You know, the one of the biggest issues I think with them is keeping them weeded. It's a perennial, so you've got to get the weeds out of there. But you also fertilize them at different times of the year. These are ones that we don't fertilize in the spring of the year. We actually fertilize them in mid-season after the fruit has set and you've picked it. Then you renovate and you fertilize at that time. And so you're really trying to really push the growth on these in August, September, and then, and that's when it's setting up the bloom for next year and the fruit for next year. So that's what we do with the strawberries.
Is there any particular fertilizer that you like to use? And you say you do this after fruiting.
Right. Again, I think a soil sample will tell me, but generally something with nitrogen, high in nitrogen. And if we need the phosphorus and potassium, then by all means, we use that. But, that's when you really want to kick them in and get them to grow again.
Yeah. And something else I find important, too, really, is before you do all this is site selection.
Right.
Is you need sun.
You do.
You've got to have sun, and you have to have good drainage.
You do. And strawberries are, we've really had a problem, especially in northern Kentucky, with a lot of the root rot complex, which is red steel and, you know, just all these, it's just a complex of fungal root diseases. And we've had some issues with that in northern Kentucky. So we have really recommend people grow them on raised beds and get that elevation up so that the drainage is better.
So is red steel, tell me a little bit about it.
It's a fungal disease.
I've heard of it, but I've,
the way it's identified is that the root system just actually turns a red, and you can kind of slip the covering of the root off of it, and it just turns it, the roots should be white, and when they're red, you've got that issue.
So the stems got a reddish color.
Not the stems, the root system.
The root system.
Yeah.
Got
and
it.
Then if the
I'm sorry.
Plant doesn't have the root system, it's just not going to support anything above ground. And we really see, and what you don't usually see death of the plants, but you just lose yield year after year.
So, and the, you know, vigor just,
yeah, it goes, it's on and, a decline. And you know, we like to keep strawberries for at least 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And what we have found is that sometimes we'll go in after year one and we'll analyze some of the plants, send them down to the diagnostic lab, and they'll come back with the root rot complex on them.
Wow. You know, is it true not to grow strawberries for 5 or more consecutive years in the same location?
Right. You really want to rotate that crop around, because it will, they will just, that soil is heavily infested with all those fungal diseases, mm-hmm. and you definitely want to move them out of that site.
What about, you know, I've read things too, and I certainly, I don't have strawberry patches. I mm-hmm. used to go down to McLassen's yeah. when I was a kid with my great grandmother, and she drove an old Ford Falcon, and we would go pick strawberries, we would pick peaches, we would pick tomatoes, sure. and all that good stuff. And that's why I think it's important to get kids interested in those right. kind of things, because I remember those, and I cherish mm-hmm. those years, and we used to have fun just picking strawberries and so forth. And,
Lon is still at it down there. He's a good friend, and, They're still at it, and he's, you know, they still are planting peaches trees every year, and they're just a wonderful group of people to work with.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I just remember McLassen's as a youngster, mm-hmm. and I need to just, you know, my wife and I need to just go down yeah. there one weekend and, yeah. and take that in. So what about planting strawberries in areas where, does this really have a negative effect where tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, and all that have been grown?
They're kind of, yeah, that can be an issue, and that's, it's best to move them out of there. It's also best with strawberries that if you really want to make sure that you've when you're preparing a site that's maybe mm-hmm. been in sod, that you really renovate that site, you rototill it up a good bit, there can be some issues with that. Strawberry soil is you know, pretty critical that you get the right soil, you get some organic matter in there, and again, you elevate that planting site. That just seems to make a big difference in how long you're able to keep that plant.
Any favorites?
Oh, I still think some of the same ones, the Early Glow.
Uh-huh. Red,
yeah, that's a great one. Jewel is a Red Chief. Those are all still pretty good strawberries, and they've been around a while. And they keep, you know, obviously they're still breeding them and coming out with stuff, but it's just fun to see those. And boy, when they're ripe, they're just isn't much better.
No, sometimes when Tina brings home quarts of strawberries, or when she brings home a cluster of grapes, she'll go, do we have any more grapes left? No, I kind of did those in, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
What about the strawberries? Now, you have to eat the strawberries rather quickly, yeah. because it doesn't take those guys long.
No, but
I think the storage life there is a little
it is,
a little
but you can certainly freeze them and do various
things. I've never frozen them. Does that alter the taste?
Oh, well, you know, it softens them somewhat. But,
yeah.
you know, there's just so many things that you can do with them. And they're just, when they're available, they're really great to have.
All right, so there you have it with strawberries. When we come back out of the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about blackberries and so forth. Those are always good, and I love blackberries, you know, on a cheesecake, you know, just And when we come back out of the break, too, we have PJ over in Alexandria has a question about some weed killers as well. 749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. We got to take another quick break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And, hey, don't forget, McCabe's biggest event of the year is taking place today. That's their Deck Expo, and it goes on from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And the B105 crew will be hanging out there as well on site from noon till 2 p.m. And other manufacturers will be there, too, with other discounts and various things that you might be interested in. So don't forget about that. McCabe's Lumber, the biggest event of the year. That's their Deck Expo today from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Also, I want to point out something. It was a few weeks ago we were down at the Home and Garden Show, and we met Justina Block, and she's the owner of Osmia Bee Company. And she's got a lot of interesting things about the Mason Bee to let you know about and tell you all about. And she's going to be at Burger Farms next Saturday, April 21st, from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. So if you're interested in bees, you definitely want to take this one in. There's a lot of interesting, intriguing information about the Mason Bee. And the Mason Bee, as a matter of fact, in case you don't know this, is more of a workhorse than the old honeybee. So take that into stride and check that out next week at Burger Farms In addition to that, Scott Byerline from the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Gardens will be there as well. And he'll present some of the zoo's best annuals, perennials, and shrubs that will make that bed of yours one of the best pollinators in the neighborhood. So remember next Saturday, a big event going on at Burger Farms from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. And I was mistaken and said PJ from Alexandria, but it's RJ. And good morning, RJ. How are you doing?
Doing good, thank you.
What's going on? What are you trying to eradicate?
I just remember a couple of weeks ago we was listening and there was a certain type of weed killer you guys were talking about, and I don't remember the name of it, but I wanted to get some of that stuff.
Is this in the lawn? We looking for something that's selective?
No, it was in the beds.
Oh, in the beds. I may have been talking about a couple of products, and if it rings a bell, just say, hey, yeah, that's it. One of those products I was talking about was High Yields Turf and Ornamental Weed and Grass Stopper, which is a granular product that contains Dimension, and that's more of a pre-emergent type of product. So it's a weed preventer. So
yeah, it was something you had mentioned, like the wild onions to kind of...
Okay, got it.
I think it was like a three-word type of name.
The Weed-Free Zone is very effective.
That's it. That's
now... that's a Fertilume product, great product, and there's an advantage of using Weed-Free Zone versus some of the other products. It's also very effective in cooler temperatures.
Okay.
And so that allows us the opportunity to start going after some pesky things early in the season and also, you know, a little later in the year. So just you'll mix up Weed-Free Zone. If you buy it in a concentrate, you can also buy it in an RTU format, which is a ready-to-use. It's almost like a little trigger spray bottle. And also hose end. But in the beds, you're probably going to be better suited with, I would do the concentrate. A lot more flexibility. If you ever need to use it in the lawn, you can go ahead and mix it and put it in a tank sprayer. But you need to bruise the onions. And I'm going to get your flair on this one in a second, David. Onions are very interesting that they have a waxy blade. And a lot of times when you're trying to spray wild onions, it repels off. So, you know, in cooler temperatures, you want to use a surfactant. I typically don't tell people to use a surfactant with Weed-Free Zone. But a surfactant is like what we call a spreader sticker. It aids the product that you're using and mixing up in a tank sprayer or whatever it is, whatever means you choose to apply it, and it helps it stick to what you're spraying, and thus it kind of facilitates absorption a lot more thoroughly and better on what it is you're trying to get rid of.
Okay.
So, and you can find that product at any of your local garden centers and nurseries that are Fertilume dealers. David, and hanging there with us here, PJ, or RJ, I'm sorry. Wild onions, have you ever... You got an approach for this?
Yeah, I think you're right. If you can, you know, sometimes if you mow them and then you treat, you've opened them up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That can help. The surfactants, of course, certainly help. And as you're applying, you know, those are going to maybe be a little bit tougher. So you want to spend a little more time with your sprayer on that spot. One of the things I will tell you that just be careful with your sprayer. I really recommend people, if they're applying any of the weed control products, just dedicate that sprayer to those and just label that for weed controls, and that'll keep you out of trouble when you you know, somebody else is maybe there using your equipment and they don't wash it out carefully enough, and some of those can have a residue and they will work on valuable landscape plants as well as weeds. So
yes, most definitely. Always label your tank sprayers, fungicides, herbicides, and so forth, and you never get into trouble. A lot of people leave products in them for a period of time before they ever clean them out. You know, RJ, one last thing, too, that's so important. When you're working within landscape beds and there's other desirables, as we call them, you know, other like shrubs and perennials and so forth, we don't want overspray on those products or those plants because you can injure them. So sometimes if it's best suited, you know, if you were to mix the product up and just kind of take one of those little sponge brushes, dip it in a solution and wipe it on the foliage of what it is you're trying to get rid of, you reduce that, you know, possibility of getting any overspray on your desirables.
Okay, excellent.
And, you know, just more is not better. We didn't talk about labels. More is not better,
That's
believe
right.
me. These companies they spend a lot of money on research and development. And think about this, you know, if 2.5 ounces wasn't sufficient, it would tell you 6, so they sell more product. So when they tell you it's 2.5 ounces to a gallon of water, that's all you need.
Yeah. They want you to be successful at the labeled rate.
Okay.
And here's another thing, just anything when it's a broadleaf weed, a lot of guys think I'm gonna scalp it and then spray it. That's not that effective. The more leaf surface that you have, the more effective that product is that you're spraying will be. There's more surface for it to get absorbed into the plant.
Okay. And I do have one more quick question.
Sure.
So in the grass where you have a lot of shade, pine trees and so forth, and you get that low, mossy, green, just junk, right, instead of grass.
Mm-hmm.
I've always heard that if you put down lime, that'll help. Is that the case?
Not necessarily. You've got that condition because you've just got a perfect environment for it. And if there's anything you can do to change that a little bit, maybe prune a little bit, get some more sunlight in there. Lime doesn't. There are some products. I think, Tony, some of the for algae and also for moss, I think some of the copper sulfate type things will work on it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to solve your problem. They're going to come back because you've got the right conditions for it. And you might want to just go with just putting mulch in that area, not trying to grow grass in there because it's, you know, grass wants full sun and you don't have it there.
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. You know, it's a vicious cycle sometimes, you know, under large trees and various situations that you just described. That environment's conducive for it. And sometimes, you know, don't try and beat it and kill yourself with grass year after year after year. You know, as David mentioned, you know, you might mulch a little further out. Sometimes, you know, you look at various things that will accompany or complement what's there that you can grow that will tolerate that situation. Maybe some more shade plants, some shade ground covers and various things. But you're usually right back to where you were.
Okay.
All right, RJ, have a great weekend. Thank you, and let us know how it goes. Always follow up with us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah, I hear it all the time. It's that moss situation, you know, and it gets really, really interesting. It can become quite tricky. Hang on to that thought, but we still want to cover a little bit with some brambles. We're talking about blackberries and raspberries and so forth when we come back out of the break. 749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. We'll be right back. Welcome back in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. The things we talk about in the break sometimes is funny. And this is good. It just happened so that David Kester knows Ed Tuas like I know Ed and the rest of the Tuas family. And you know, I was just telling David, it's like, you ever shake Ed's hand, you know, I mean, it's like, he'll tear it up. You're like, oh man, it's all about the handshake. You said it's the same
thing. It's the whole family, his brother, he's an investment, and when he sees you, I mean, it's just, they let you know that, they give you that good firm handshake.
Are you talking about Bob?
Yes.
Oh, Bob. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was on a snowmobiling trip with Bob out in Yellowstone. He invited me and it was one of the best trips I've ever taken in my life. Yeah. And, but we were just cutting up. And like I said, the things we talk about in a break.
That's an amazing family.
Yeah. Great people.
Poultry business.
Yeah, it was hilarious. But I try when I shake Ed's hand, I want to do it real quick and get out of there.
That's right.
You know, that's my beer holding hand right there, Ed.
I don't know how they keep it so strong. Well, Ed, of course, is in the concrete business.
Yeah.
That explains that. I don't know how Bob does it.
Yeah. But we were talking about, before we went into the break, brambles and so forth. Mm-hmm. Is it late right now to think about still pruning out some of the old, you know, the floricanes and so forth. And
Boy. And
let's get into this discussion because with blackberries and raspberries, you know, we have various situations that come about that you'll have the primo canes and then the next year that primo cane becomes the floricane. That's your fruiting cane.
Right.
And then after that, you need to eliminate it. And there's even new varieties now that they're all floricanes when they pop up.
That's,
so where are we in the grand scheme of things?
That's really helped. I don't think you're too late. I think by saying you're too late, and not doing, I think it would be a drastic mistake. Mm-hmm. I would rather prune late than not at all. So I would be pruning those. And there's a lot of, you know, Tony, there's some good videos on some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I'm better with a video than I am reading something about how to prune them.
Well, you're a typical guy. Yeah, it's all illustrations
exactly,
for us, right?
Yeah. but you know, you're right. There are some just really neat they're newer.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got some ever-bearing red raspberries, and I think the red raspberry is the premium fruit to me. And they bear on current season's growth. So you can plant them, and then the growth that comes up, they will fruit on that this year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of that is that you don't have to learn how to prune them. You just get out a mower or your pruning shears in the fall of the year or the first thing in the spring,
mm-hmm.
and you cut them off at ground level. And the growth that reemerges from that will flower that year and will have fruit on it that year. And that just, you know, takes all the guesswork out of it.
Right.
So I think, and they are developing new ones. There's some blackberries now that will do that, and black raspberries that will do that. And they all come out of, most of this breeding work comes out of the University of Arkansas. And I can't remember his name. There's a doctor down there, and he has just been phenomenal with his breeding research.
Mm-hmm.
And all these, and a lot of them have Indian names, which a lot of the Native American tribes in that area, and he names these blackberries after them. And some of the good ones are Wachita is a real nice one, and there's just several others that are out there. And there's also one that he has kind of named after. It's called Prime Arc Freedom, and that's a blackberry. And it is now one that we can take down to ground level, and it will reemerge with floricanes that will bloom on current season's wood. So it's what's the beauty of that is you don't have to learn how to prune them. You just have to know how to cut them down to ground level.
Yeah, you know, I think that's awesome when you start coming out with new cultivars and it simplifies things like that.
Right.
Do you ever think that might take away the old varieties and progress and become?
I doubt it. I think there's still an awful lot of people that really like some of those old ones. Triple Crown I keep hearing about,
mm-hmm.
and Chester and some of those. You know, it's, people have those and they just really like them, and they've learned how to grow them and do that. And you know, put them on a trellis and that. A lot of people do prefer the thornless to the thorny.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, you know, a thorny blackberry is one mean plant. It really has some nasty thorns.
So you're going into it with what, like those rose gloves and all that other good stuff?
You better. I always tell the story that when my kids were, you know, young, we were playing baseball, and whenever the baseball landed underneath the blackberries, it was my job to go get it. I didn't want any part of it.
Just leave it there. We're done. We're finished. Yeah. You know, I love blackberries, and especially when, you know, it was last year, someone had brought me a cheesecake and did the blackberry kind of like a jam. Mm-hmm. Just drizzled it over it.
Right.
And it's just like, oh, man, this is a slice of heaven right here.
That's one I wish we could get more people to grow, especially some of our commercial growers. You know, they'd be great additions to a farmer's market. We don't have to spray them nearly as intensively as we do tree fruit. We do have a new insect that we're battling, that spotted ring Drosophila. That has really become a real nuisance, and we're trying to get earlier maturing fruit now that comes on and can be picked before the insect comes out.
So is there any other remedy?
There are sprays that you can do, and you really need to follow them carefully. It's all about timing with those, and we can spray, but it's one that it can be a miserable experience if you don't, because you usually don't see, but it will lay eggs into some of the fruit that's ripening, and you don't know that it's been there until you go to eat it or harvest it, and you'll see all the larvae kind of wiggling around in the fruit.
Ooh.
Not real appetizing.
No. That's almost like getting a hair and something on your plate. It's like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Oh, hold on. Don't hold on to that thought. But we're going to take another quick break. 749-B105, in and around the house with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And we'll continue our discussion with edibles when we come back. Good morning. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys. And boy, I tell you what, we've had a string of, we had a couple nice days here in the 70s, and things really ramped up and heated up around the workplace. And when I say that, I'm talking about the garden centers here locally in the tri-state area. And although we got some rain in the forecast today, do not allow that to stop you or keep you from getting out to your local garden centers and nurseries. And remember, stay local, spend local, because on average, every dollar that you spend locally, you're supporting your local economy. 67 cents of every dollar stays locally versus some of those big out-of-town guys. You know, you're looking at around 41 cents, huge difference. And besides that, you know, it's not just local garden centers and nurseries. It's all of your local businesses. So important. They are the cornerstones of our communities. And keep them in mind when you're out shopping. And also, too, and there's a little rain in the forecast today, I know the butterfly show's taking place over at the Crone Conservatory. What a wonderful gem that we have in our backyard to take in such a wonderful show. Have you ever taken in the
absolutely. It's one of my favorite places. It really is. It's, and they do such a tremendous job at changing, you know, various seasons of the year. But I love the butterflies, and, you know, their spring show is just phenomenal.
Yeah, you know, just the other day, I was invited to go to one of the beekeeping meetings up in the Brown County Beekeeping group or society. And it was Emily Archibald from the Ohio Division of Wildlife gave a wonderful presentation. I told you a little bit about that, but some of the handouts, I mean, it's like I can't get enough.
Right.
And, you know, they were on various butterflies of Ohio and it was so interesting, and it got as deep as each butterfly. It would tell you the various differences. And I didn't know this. The Viceroy butterfly is very similar looking to the monarch, but on the dorsal side, the lower hind wing, there's a black streak. It's very thin. That tells you the difference between the two. The monarch does not have that, but the Viceroy does. And it goes as far as, David, to tell you more about various butterflies and their host plant preferences. Just incredible. Right. Incredible. I have to show you that when I can dig that out. With that said, we're going down near Racetrack World in Sparta, and we have Colleen with us. Good morning, Colleen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. So do we come in loud and clear in Sparta?
You do.
Oh, awesome. awesome. Have you ever been over the hill and down into Warsaw to see a good friend of mine, Zach Bledsoe, at Clover Farms?
I live like 2 miles from Warsaw. Yeah, and there's another shop down there too. Yeah, that's a very it's a good place to go.
Yeah, good people. So, what's going on? What do you have for us this morning?
Well, I mean, you had the veggie garden guy kind of. I felt like on the air today, and I have tomatoes and pepper plants, and I usually plant them indoors all the time. Every year, I start in January, February, whatever. And this year, it seems like, I don't know, I just am looking at them right now. They're all spindly. They are starting to get 3-4 leaves on them, five leaves on them. But they're, like, real long and spindly, and they're falling over. And I'm going, like, I know we got to later start this. And I'm one of those ones that cheats May, Mother's Day, and I put them in early.
Yeah.
But they're still in my house, and they look horrible. And I'm just like, what is going on this year?
Are you using artificial light or just sunlight?
I started out, you know, with the seeds, I started out under plastic, under a cover, and then they were sitting in a they sit in a window with a curtain that's a kind of a sheer curtain, so they get like kind of an indirect kind of sort of sunlight.
I think your issue is we've just had so much cloud and so little sunlight, and I think you just need those just need a lot more light than they're getting. And you can do that with just some fluorescent lights put down very close to them, or you can hope for more sunlight in the next couple of weeks. But I think they're just stretching because they're just not getting enough sunlight.
Okay, because the gentleman that he was just talking about, Zach, because he came in and he goes, tomato plants are really resilient, you know. Just don't worry about watering them all the time. Don't worry about that. You know, I'm going like, well, they sure don't look very good.
No. You know, he used to be the largest potato chip grower in the state of Kentucky.
No kidding.
Well, yep.
I heard stories about that a long time ago.
Yeah, I was actually on his farm.
And his wife owns the little flower shop up front, and I've been there so many times, they know me by heart. They're going like, hey, you're back.
They are wonderful people. They are the salt of the earth. And and if you're down there anytime soon in the next couple of weeks, please tell, give them a hello from us.
I will. But, I work down there, too, and they come in and say hi to me all the time. So I will tell them hi.
You know, going back to your plant question, this is interesting. You know, what in relation to what Zach was saying too, with tomato plants, we can plant those deeper when we transplant. However, peppers we're not that fortunate.
No.
You don't want to plant peppers deep. So really, the timing comes into play there. And as David said, you know, any fluorescent light, you know, I agree with him, will suffice, and just put them down close to it. You know, and sometimes too. Do you have any heat mats? Have you ever invested into like a germination heating mat?
No.
I've been
so wanting to do like greenhouse, and we're talking about this next year. But this year, no, we didn't do anything.
Yeah,
you know,
that in itself will allow you. You would be amazed how quick things germinate when they're over a heat mat. And that will allow you not to have to really concentrate or worry as much about starting things a little early and start them a little later and get them right in sync with, you know, what's going on typically with our weather here in the Cincinnati area. I mean, it doesn't take long to get peppers up on, you know, germinating on a heat mat. So you can postpone that just a little bit.
Well, as long as they are now, and like I said, I'm looking at them right now. They got like 5 leaves on top.
Yeah.
Should I take them out of their little things and plant them deeper in a bigger pot now? Not a huge pot, but, you know, they're still real spindly.
Yeah, transplanting will probably toughen them up as well, and definitely plant them deeper than they are now. And then, and as you know, we've been telling you, go ahead and get those under some lights and keep the lights on about 18 hours a day on them, and make sure that they're no more than 4 inches away from the tops of the plants.
Okay. All right.
Do you have a cold frame? You know,
No. They're
on cool nights, you know, where we are this time of year, a cold frame really helps harden off tomato plants, too.
Yeah, I don't have that either.
Yeah.
Like I said, I've been doing that. I mean, like last year I had like 40 tomato plants and pepper and everything, and I have Rick replowed some more land for me this year, but it's like, usually I just go out and plant the corn and plant the seeds and plant everything. It's just my tomato and pepper plant. I've never had the cold frame or put the heat mat down. I've never done that.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you. Keep us in the loop and let us know how it goes. And we're going to take another quick break. We have Linda from Reading hanging on with us. She has some issues with some ants. 749-B105 in and around the house with Tony and Ernie. When we come back, Linda, we'll get right to you. Welcome back to In and Around the House with Tony and Ernie, your local home and gardening guys, and we're going to go into the Reading area. We have Linda waiting for us. Thanks, Linda, for waiting. What's going on?
Yes. Over the period of the years that we've lived in this house, we've occasionally got little tiny ants in the spring, very shortly, and they always came in, around the kitchen area.
Right, right.
This year, it's like they've had a main trail, and we were like at a miss to what to do. They got into the dishwasher, the stove, the microwave.
Oh, wow.
They really came in, and we were aware that there was a few of them running around and did what we could.
Right.
But had no idea the extent of, we don't even know where they're coming from, what area of the side of the yard, or if they're under the house.
Right, right.
Or... we've never had this problem, so...
You know, it's interesting. I answered an ant question for somebody, I think, on Facebook. But a couple of things, if the infestation isn't in such a way where it's so severe that you can kind of do some home remedies yourself and see if, in fact, that's successful is one thing. And we'll talk about that in a second. However, if it's pretty noticeable and it's really bothersome and it's kind of out of control, then I always suggest to people like yourself, homeowners, you might have a professional exterminator take a look at it.
Yeah.
And, I'm going to give you this information first, and then we'll come back to maybe some home approaches. But Ken Webbs, W-E-B-Z, I've been out on some interesting things with him in the past, and He's an exterminator. I would certainly, you know, give a call, have him take a look at it. And his number is 513.
Yes.
987-9329. Yeah. And, you know, your ants are a little different, it sounds like to me, than the carpenter ants. You know, when you see carpenter ants in and around your home, they can be destructive. So that's definitely when I wouldn't take things into my own hands.
Yeah, these are the little tiny, tiny ants.
Right. And, you know, you might see Ernie with those guys because he loves to follow ants to a picnic. You know, so... And he'll be distinguishable in that group of people right there.
Yeah, we've already got, you know, had the stove out and cleaned.
Right.
Yeah.
Microwave and, you know, under the cabinet and, you know, we haven't pulled the refrigerator out yet. Yeah. But, you know, it's just...
Well, they're a nuisance. And, you know, obviously you don't want them in the house. They're not really of any great harm. It's just that, you know, you don't want them there. And... some of the things, there's an awful lot of products that can be sold, the aerosols and things like that. You can, boric acid is one that seems to be really good and fairly safe just with any of these things. Make sure you read the directions, and some of them are kind of a little bit of an oil base, so they'll stay there, and they'll give you a little bit of residual activity with them. And, but just if you've got pets, small kids, obviously you want to be really careful with what you use. Vinegar is, I think
is vinegar?
I think they use a, there's a, you know, and you can look this up, but, some of those, remedies are pretty effective as well. And I don't think it's going to be a season long problem for you. I think you'll see it right now. And then, when, they'll prefer to be outside as well.
Yeah, and, you know, try to walk around the perimeter of the house and see if you see any or notice any activity, you know, around the foundation, around your windows, around your garage doors, your doors and so forth, and check the seals, you know, on your garage door and various things, and even on your front door. A lot of times, you know, they whenever they find a way in, you know, they just manage to that develop and establish that trail, and they all travel that same trail. You know, cinnamon, too, I heard, is very effective. Mm-hmm. With
really?
The ants, yeah. And,
I hadn't heard that one.
And certainly be careful in the kitchen area, especially, you know, if you're cooking a lot and preparing food and so forth, you definitely have to, you don't want to introduce things that aren't really good to have around.
Right.
And, you know, you might start outside, too. A lot of times those, you know, those issues come from outside. And I agree with David. Typically, it's not an all-season issue, you know, for the most part. You know, just certain times of the year, you'll see more activity than others.
Yes.
But Linda, you know, sometimes I don't know if some of those little traps, those little bait traps are, you know, any success using. I just know that I'll try a couple things myself personally. And if I don't seem to get, you know, control over the issue, then I kind of go to guns and bring somebody in that knows more about it than I. But certainly, you know, give it a whirl yourself. Try and find that entry point. And if not, I gave you Ken's information. And, you know, there's so many different types of ants, you know. It's there's even one called the robber ant. I don't mean if that's your Aunt Lou that comes over and happens to have sticky fingers and you're missing something when she leaves. But I'm just saying that facetiously. But, yeah, let us know what you find out. And if, in fact, you give Ken a call, certainly follow up with us.
All righty.
All right, Linda, you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
I hope Aunt Lou wasn't listening this morning.
No, yeah. I don't. You know, I just like that robbery. You know, it kind of reminds me of that commercial, too, where they were talking. It was a retirement commercial, and some friends came over, and they were sitting on the sofa, and the homeowners walked behind them and kind of shook, you know, patted them on the shoulders, hoping money would fall out of their pockets down into the sofa crevices. You know, to help supplement retirement. You
sure.
Know, you want those kind of relatives. But anyway, maybe I'm not that funny after all. But what are you laughing about over there, John? You're always on me. You're always on me like a cheap suit. But, you know, it's been a great morning, David. I really appreciate you taking the time out to get up early and travel all the way in from the south end of the county. And typically, you usually bring us some interesting weather, to say the least.
I know. I don't know how I do that, but it has happened.
Yeah.
But usually, this is fun.
Usually, it's snow.
Yeah,
you know,
I know.
It's always snow. But hey, you know, do me a favor, please stay in contact with us. And, you know, anytime you have something going on out there at the extension office, you know, feel free to call us. We can do phone-ins. And, you know, you guys do a wonderful job. So do all three of our extension offices. And I know that we're very fortunate in Northern Kentucky to have the extension services that provide the services that you guys do for us all. And, you know, soil samples, too. Take them out to David Boone County, Kenton County, out there with Michelle Stanton and Sarah
Stoles
over in Campbell County. Know what your soil is comprised of. That soil sample will save you a lot of headaches. Next week, hopefully, we'll find Ernie's whereabouts, and everything will be back to normal. We'll see you next Saturday.